This is fun! The FU Network.
This is the Broken Clock Podcast, First Achievement Unlocked. I didn't mess up the name. This episode, we are tackling something really heavy. You think critical race theory last time was heavy? Hold on to your butts. The men's rights movement, just the name makes some people shudder. The precursors of this movement started in the 1950s, but the men's rights movement really got going in the 1960s and 1970s when second wave feminism succeeded in major changes to many aspects of law, most notably divorce law. The men's rights movement got another shot in the arm during the 1990s when third wave feminism achieved changes to sexual assault laws. But both sides of the men's rights activism debate are prone to excessive emotionality and foolishness with headlines like, "Why the men's rights movement is garbage," really not helping anything regarding critical thinking. So I'm once again joined by my partner in thought crimes, Mouse Mary Jest, to take a mostly serious look at the arguments made by the men's rights movement. And considering that Mouse is an actual real life man, I'm assuming he has opinions. No, Mouse. We're not going to start from a Kantian perspective. The fact that you are male is knowable. You are objectively male. So I'm going to give you the first word, man. Did we just start on an Ayn Rand reference? Everybody has to take a drink now.
Okay, take a shot, people. Yeah,
take a shot. First Ayn reference of the podcast. I get the sense there's going to be a lot of Ayn Rand versus Immanuel Kant today. But I suspect
this podcast might create a couple of alcoholics at this point.
I'm sure you have opinions on this subject.
I do.
Okay.
But also, interestingly enough, you know that the term, the men's rights, was used even before the 20th century. In fact, this most interesting specimen first appeared in the 1800s Putnam's Magazine. And you had a league, the League for Men's Rights in Austria, which was formed with the goal of combating all excesses of women's emancipations.
That's right.
While many people do agree that the men's rights movement has moments in which it asks important questions and speaks of legitimate grievances or legitimate objections, like many movements that we have seen in recent decades, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say decades. It has kind of become hijacked by an almost cult-like mentality in which you have people who feel, for one reason or another, that they have been oppressed or that they're being slighted or that they are being targeted. In any case, they feel that they are vulnerable in one sense or another. Whether it is accurate or not is really not the question here. It is the fact that they feel this and that they experience some level of distress intellectually, emotionally over this. And then you have a group of people, of ideologues, that propose a solution. But the way that this solution is proposed is done in such a way that first it seeks to validate the existential anguish, so to speak, saying, yes, you are not, you're not crazy. You have valid complaints. And if it were that, if it left it off at that point, then you go, okay, well, this is a step towards healing or towards making some progress. But the problem is that many of these movements, and in this case, a lot of exponents of the men's rights movements, they don't stop there. In fact, it is almost as if the movement themselves are engineered towards ratcheting up that existential malaise, because the rhetoric that comes out of these groups are, you are not alone, you are not insane, you're right, but you're also wrong because it is so much worse than you could have ever imagined.
Yeah. which is why I wanted to do this right after the critical race theory episode, because I, you know, wanted to sort of spread it out. They're all sort of postmodern constructs, aren't they?
Yes.
They start with a good idea and then totally shit the bed.
Yes, it's really, really very strange because, you know, as you remember back in the 80s, back in the 70s and the 60s, you had all of these concerned parents about that were worried about the rise of cults in Latin America. We had we had Satanism every year. It was Satanism. It was
really?
Satanism everywhere. Yeah. No. Brief tangent. At my high school, we had a very, very concerned person who obviously charged a lot of money to speak at schools for this, but we had for 4 years in a row, we had the same speaker telling us how Guns N' Roses and David Bowie and Michael Jackson were all in league with the devil, and that never to accept Blue Star pasties or, you know, temporary tattoos because they contain an LSD mixture that would make you worship Satan. It was crazy.
That made it all the way down there. I'm very impressed.
You had the Blue Star thing too?
The temporary tattoos laced with LSD, yeah. Of course, nobody believed it.
No, nobody believed it.
We all, this is how science-minded kids in the Jane Finch neighborhood of Toronto were in the 80s, that we licked the temporary tattoo. And if all was good after a few minutes, we went with it because we figured, like, all right, we're not tripping balls. Proceed. Because, I mean, that's the problem, right? Like, I really do believe a lot of this stuff comes from the failed war on drugs in World War I because we were fed such utter hyperbolic bullshit during the 80s about almost everything.
Dungeons and Dragons, for crying out loud.
Well, the whole idea of mourning in America was even sort of a front, right?
So they
say that, you know, Generation X is defined by how jaded we are, but the truth is there's very good reasons for that. We had to hit a point, and it was different for everybody, but we all hit a point where everything we were told was bullshit. I mean, my moment's incredibly nerdy. For a lot of people, it was, you know, the first time they tried marijuana. I've never smoked marijuana in my life. I know, nobody believes me, but I haven't. For me, the bullshit moment was when I found out that the periodic table as taught in schools was a lie.
You encountered lies to children.
Yeah, well, it was the fact that the periodic table would just be way too long if it was actually properly presented. So, you know, those two rows of elements that are at the bottom?
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason that they're at the bottom except for the fact that if they were actually in the proper place, the periodic table would be too long.
Right. You would have a periodic tapestry.
Right.
Like the Bayeux tapestry.
Yeah. And for some reason, that tapestry realization, all of a sudden, the entire world became like Heronius Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. It was just too much. And all of it was awful. Right.
I like the moment when you discover that what they told you in school about how rainbows are formed is not actually quite the fully accurate.
Right. And it has nothing to do with Lucky Charms cereal.
Yeah.
Or LSD. But I mean, I do think I've read a lot of narratives, first person narratives, because for the men's rights movement, because ironically, the modern men's rights movement got its start thanks to a jaded male feminist who got, well, his marriage ended when he asked a question he basically didn't want an answer to, according to him. But it was a gent named Warren Farrell who wrote a book called The Myth of Male Power in the 90s after separating from his wife, who was an IBM executive. And so he was the lower income earner, all this stuff. And he went from being praised by Gloria Steinem and company to being sort of the guy who wrote the definitive book on what would become the men's rights movement. And he uses a lot of the not good parts of feminist argument, the stuff that is very first person narrative, the stuff mm-hmm. that is very emotionally charged. You know, he uses things like the fact that the feminist group SCUM stands for Society for Cutting Up Men, stuff yeah. like that. You know, the fact that a lot of second wave feminists argument is actually very poorly argued, very propagandistic and emotional. And mm-hmm. it's very interesting because Warren Farrell's stuff, it's pretty tame by what most people think of as men's rights activist rhetoric. But then again, everything that has to be published in an actual book seems tame by the standards of the internet. So I guess that's no surprise. But, you know, he wrote fairly consistently and spoke fairly consistently. And then he got remarried in 2002. And then all of a sudden he became interested in dialogue with the other side.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, and so many of these, you know, titans of the men's rights movement, their narratives are deeply personal. They all start with some personal heartbreak. It actually reminds me a lot, you may get this, listeners may not, of Dave Sims' misogynist writings after his wife left him. And at least like the comic book writer, the creator of Cerebus the Aardvark, at least he was self-aware enough to call them the misogynist writings.
Right. Like, and for those of you who are not familiar, that entire period created a trope called the Cerebus syndrome.
Yes. Yeah. And it was basically, I don't know exactly how to define the Cerebus syndrome without being glib. So maybe you should take a crack at it.
The way that a Cerebus syndrome is usually identified is when a creator has gone through a traumatic development or a deeply emotionally disturbing one. And so content that at one point may have been lighthearted, heroic, or aspirational or optimistic, or made solely for the purpose of entertainment, suddenly takes a very dark turn,
right,
where you can see a jaded attitude. Plots become, in many cases, extremely overcomplicated. And this is, of course, especially jarring if they weren't so before. There is a lot of angst, a lot of anger. I've just basically described the arc of what happened to Neon Genesis Evangelion. As you know, that the creator also suffered through a mental breakdown throughout during the creation process, and that is.
I would also argue that the Harry Potter books suffer from some of this.
Yeah, you can tell.
By around book five, she gets really pissed at her own series, but I think like the thing that allowed everybody to pounce on Dave Sim. And, you know, he was way ahead of the curve because he got called a Nazi back in, God, what was it? I don't remember when this happened, but it was way, way before current trends. He dared to self-label his writing as misogynist. And I think that some people learned from that, and instead of outright calling their stuff anti-feminist, they created this euphemism of the men's rights movement. Mm-hmm. And this is where I start going, I would actually prefer it be called anti-feminist writing.
Right, because
you know, if you're anti-religious, if you're anti-abortion, like, it's the same thing as calling people who are against abortion pro-lifers, right? You're
right.
Against a particular act, right? If you are that, at least you're being honest. The issue I have with men's rights activists, and this is what makes them go crazy, they get really, really angry at me, and it becomes extremely emotional very quickly, and I'm never quite prepared for this because I'm coming at it from a place of logic, is I say, I totally agree that there are issues with feminism. I totally agree that there are certain issues that uniquely or, you know, affect men more than women. I mean, stuff like, you know, for instance, the suicide epidemic, bottling up your feelings, all those, all that stuff. You know, men over 50 are the most likely people anywhere to die by suicide.
These which has been discussed in another podcast in the FU network.
Yeah, that's correct. Recently, check it out. But like, these are not issues of rights. These are issues of identity. These are issues of self. But when you start talking about rights, you're talking about very, very specific things that are defined and are outlined. And this is where the reasoning breaks down and the raw, it's almost like a primal scream of emotionality that men are not allowed to express kicks in. And I blame Immanuel Kant. Mouse, I warned you this was coming pre-show. I blame
Comes.
Here it comes. Blame the Lutherans. No, not all Lutherans. Just one particular Lutheran.
Just one particular Lutheran.
My issue with Immanuel Kant is having read, I think it was 19 when I started reading Immanuel Kant. When a 19-year-old...
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah. And then I hit Schopenhauer and I started... Oh. I actually went back to Aristotle after Schopenhauer. And that tells you how frustrated I was with the whole process.
At least you didn't end it up with Schleiermacher.
Well, I cleansed my palate with the Tao of Willie Nelson.
There we go.
Which is actually a wonderful book. Taoism by way of redneck. It's fantastic. But the issue I always had with Kant is he was like the original poster boy for what we now call toxic masculinity.
He
couldn't handle the concept of belief. So he had to create this ridiculously wordy nonsense concept of a priori knowledge, which is the idea that you can just know things without experience. And this to me is sort of the root of why men bottle up their feelings. Because let's face it, even the Stoics, the Greek Stoics, did not get that fucking ridiculous.
No, they did. So the Stoics had this stance that it was actually, in many ways, it was almost the Roman version of Buddhism in many ways, because...
Absolutely. Yes. I actually got a job arguing exactly what you're... about writing for video games, arguing what you're about to argue. The Stoics did not advocate bottling up or repressing emotions. It was about letting it flow through you and just experiencing it and not acting on it.
Right. So, for example, in the Enchiridion, Epictetus mentioned, I do not remember, of course, the exact wording, because I'm not that type of a monster. But he says, for example, if you lose your son, for example, if your son dies, you will experience grief. And the Stoics were against any overt or what they considered to be an excessive demonstration of feeling of any kind, because they believed that that clouded reason.
Well, there was also the context of the ancient Greeks had this idea that if you didn't cry at your buddy's funeral, it was proof you didn't care about him.
Right. And, you know, in ancient Greece, you actually, you could even hire professional mourners to wail their little lungs out while they followed the funeral procession, because that would give also people the impression that, oh, this is a good man or a good woman who has died. Look at how many people are absolutely fucking crazy with grief over over his or her death.
It was performative emotion, not legitimate feeling.
Right. And, you know, this is the culture that created the Greek tragedy, which if there's anything more performative about that type of tragedy, such as, you know, Jocasta plucking her eyes out and killing herself.
It was, it's funny, bit of an aside. I remember editing in a creative writing course, this Roman Catholic kid wrote this piece of creative writing calling a Catholic funeral like it was an Olympic sport.
Oh my gosh.
And it was in this tradition, the fact that, you know, Italian Catholic weddings, as told by this teenager, it was all about, you know, who could basically pole vault into the coffin while wailing at the top of their lungs to prove who loved them best. And it was just this wonderful, almost Mark Twain style observation of a kid going, this is all crap.
Yes, and that's also very Ecuadorian too, the gigantic grief. I don't know if I told you, but the morning after my mother died and we had the funeral, I sang at her funeral the very next morning. And people looked at me as if I were this denatured creature that was able, capable
you weren't
of doing
inconsolable?
That. Yeah, because I wasn't falling apart.
Wow.
And
I'm sure you were inside. It's
well,
just...
I prepared myself. Mm-hmm. My brother dealt with it by being in denial, but I knew this was coming. It was cancer. Mm-hmm. So for 4 or 5 months before this happened, I was basically just trying to accept, you know, basically I turned to the Taoist notion of, you know, reality, you know, reality is what it is, which is intersects with Ayn Rand, take a shot.
everybody drink.
Because, you know, life is what it is. Reality is what it is. You cannot falsify it. And, you know, I went, well, my mother is going to die. And mm-hmm. I would allow myself to feel that grief. I would try to deal through it and not just throw it aside. And it still hurts. You know, it's been only 3 years and it still hurts. What Epictetus would say is, and this is a very, very, very parallel belief to Buddhism. You know, he was never your son. He was life's son. And you never had him, and now that he was taken away from you, you know, you haven't lost him, you know. To destroy yourself grieving over this is not logical. Now, of course, I do believe that a lot of the Stoics did not quite understand how emotion works and how to deal through emotion. I think Seneca was probably the most well-grounded of mm-hmm. them as far as that goes. But yeah, the Stoics had nothing on this tendency of the false Stoicism that arose in the 50s, and this image
it was earlier than that. It was the Great War period. It was World War One, World
right,
War II,
World War
when I. when multiple generations of men were walking around with what they called combat fatigue.
What was
PTSD? At the time, it was PTSD. Right. But they thought at the time the best thing to do with war traumatized men was to send them back out into battle so they don't have time to think about it. And then when they came home, they had to give them cushy, artificial nuclear family and, you know, steady jobs with the big car and the house with the white picket fence. It was all artifice, right? Mm-hmm. And they thought by creating these structures, they could prevent post-traumatic stress.
And as Emily Dickinson used to say, narcotics cannot steal the tooth that nibbles at the soul.
And I think that this is part of the issue with, and this is why I want to be generous. I want to do sort of a Hillelian method, the Jewish philosopher Hillel, mm-hmm. with the men's rights movement, is I felt the need to completely understand and be able to explain the men's rights movement point of view before I attempt to say, here's why I disagree. Because I think it is important to give enough respect to someone you disagree with to treat them as worthy of understanding. Mm-hmm. And what the men's rights movement does not internalize is exactly what you seized on with the death of your mother and Stoics and Buddhism. She was never mine. This possessive approach to relationships, that masculinity is about having the one marriage that never falters, you know, and the one job you keep for your entire adult life. And this false idea of permanence that was drilled into men in North America and Western Europe, at least. Eastern Europe was a little bit different because of what was going on with, you know, the Nazis rolled out and the communists rolled in. But, you know, this idea of false permanence, when it all started to fall apart in the 60s and 70s, because it was an artificial lifestyle that could never last. It was the ultimate in big government initiatives, right? They misidentified, they incorrectly identified the cause as the feminist movement, as opposed to the natural decay of something that was being propped up by artificial pretense.
And they also never asked, what is it that is causing the feminist movement, as in, what is the root cause that is creating this reaction?
Well, because they were too busy reacting to think that deeply. Like, you know as well as I do, critical thinking comes from a place of stillness. You don't turn off your emotions, but you kind of sit next to them, right?
Yes.
That's a big part of critical thinking.
That's why Taoism is very useful.
Very. And I think maybe the Taoists were possibly the original critical thinkers, even though it's done in the language of emotion. You can't separate emotion from critical thinking. It has to be sort of like a conjoined twin.
Yeah.
And it's almost like masculinity got stunted during the World War I, World War II period, because what people forget is that first wave feminism, the feminist movement basically got put on pause because of the war effort. Mm-hmm. So instead of worrying about suffrage and rights for working women and all that stuff, it was like, well, now we have to mobilize behind the whole war effort. Bye-bye corsets. We need the steel for ships.
Yes.
And it's interesting because the first wave feminists were very, very effective in war mobilization. Go them. But it never stopped. The desires never stopped. The desire for equality never stopped. But it was like there was like this 10-year lull after the wars ended, that sort of got interrupted by Simone de Beauvoir publishing, you know, Le Deuxième Sexe, A Second Sex.
Le Deuxième Sexe.
She was French, because of course she was.
Because of course.
The French had a very unique position during the wars. But our modern concepts of what is considered traditional masculinity and traditional femininity actually don't go back that far. They actually only go back to World War II.
Yeah.
That is a very short tradition.
Because if you look at one of my favorite accounts about George Washington, is when he was in his older later years, he was speaking before a group of soldiers who had fought with him. So many of them were of advanced age. Mm-hmm. And at one moment, he had to stop his speech. And he started fishing for his spectacles, his glasses. Mm-hmm. And he apologized and said, I am sorry. I need to put on my glasses. My life of service to this country has greatly impaired my vision. Mm-hmm. And these are soldiers. Mm-hmm. And the men, many of the men started crying at seeing their general, George Washington, reduced to being this frail old man.
Yes.
But you had men weeping openly, and that was not an unusual phenomenon. You had accounts of men that were considered to be masculine, or at least who embodied the ideas of what a man was in the 19th, 18th century, openly weeping, openly mourning, and not concealing their emotions. In fact, that
continues up to the Victorian age. I mean, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle describes in detail Sherlock Holmes having a nervous breakdown.
Oh, yeah. And interestingly enough, if you see some of the characters that openly, that conceal or only show certain emotions, for example, Heathcliff,
who shows we're going into one of my pet peeve areas.
Yeah, who shows the you know, Heathcliff is kind of a Byronic villain in many ways, but
almost,
you know,
a parody, I would say. I mean, I argue that a lot of that stuff is satire. Yeah,
but you have characters of that nature are not shown in a favorable light, despite what many, many confused people think about their ship with Heathcliff.
Yeah.
pet peeve.
This is a whole other topic, like the Brontes, Jane Austen, that whole period.
They had a type.
Yeah, for people who are confused right now, we're not talking about the orange cartoon cat. We're talking about the character from Wuthering Heights.
I want to see a reenactment of Wuthering Heights with the cast of Heathcliff the cat.
My god, a furry Wuthering Heights. That could work. That could work. I mean, stories of vindictive cruelty told through cats. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect.
It's perfect. But we're digressing.
It's perfect.
I walked into that one. Okay. Yes, remember, I said mostly serious, but yes. we're doing this history for a reason. We're showing that up until, you know, warfare on a scale the world had never seen before, masculinity was actually a much more fluid, open concept. You know, ideas of what marriage was, especially among the nobility, were totally different. The dandy was a semi-acceptable part of society. We didn't have...
Like Oscar Wilde was not an outcast.
Well, if he had of just not gone after the like that. That was the interesting thing about Oscar Wilde, is he's held up as this martyr, but really it was a shining example of shooting your mouth off and not knowing when to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's really not dealt with in terms of the way Oscar Wilde is remembered. But yeah, there was a greater tolerance of a lot of things in the pre-Great War period, because people just didn't talk about it. Right. It was sort of private life was private. Public life was public.
Mm-hmm.
With the wars, the entire world became traumatized in one way or another. And we got these very artificial ideals of masculinity and femininity that were never going to last. They were not sustainable constructs. And, you know, this idea that women were supposed to be completely satisfied with just, you know, the domestic sphere. Ask Leda Lovelace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ask Leda Lovelace how she feels about that, right?
Yeah, I know.
You know, ask Sappho. Yeah, ask Sappho how she feels about that. Like, you know, it's nonsense.
Ask Georges Sand how she felt about that.
Yeah, I mean... The whole pushing women back into the domestic sphere was forced because, like I said, combat trauma. So we have three entire, I guess, generations. You're going from the mid-1910s to 49. And then all of a sudden, they're all force-fed this propagandistic bill of goods about what men and women are supposed to be. And then it all decayed. Mm-hmm. And so we get the men's rights movement now, where all of a sudden the cork popped on the champagne bottle of masculine emotional expression. And we have a group of men who desperately feel things, but do not have any language to express these feelings other than the Greeks and Kantian metaphysics filtered through the language of the founding of America. So we get these declarations of rights because that's acceptable. Uh-huh. Now, the founding fathers didn't even get rights accurate. I mean, the Three-Fifths Compromise was absurd, but it was just that. It was a compromise.
Yeah.
And this idea that some legitimate issues that men's rights activists talk about are framed as rights as where we get into problems and where the thinking needs to be checked on critical thinking grounds. But because everything is so emotional, that's almost impossible to do, because both sides, you know, the feminist side and the men's rights or anti-feminist side, are just both bashing at each other in the language of extreme emotion instead of actually thinking about it. So I'd like to tackle for the rest of the podcast some actual concepts, some issues, you know, regarding men's issues couched in the idea of rights, and actually take a critical perspective on it. And the problem is, when I was doing research, there's no actual agreement of what are the priorities for the men's rights movement. It seems to be all over the place.
It is not that uncommon when you have a movement that starts as a reactionary movement, because you have, you can agree on what you are reacting against, or I guess reacting to, but you don't really have a consensus on what exactly is the battle plan forward. Many Gates movements show that kind of that trajectory.
I mean, the two big buckets seem to be criminal justice and incarceration, and then marriage and children. Those seem to be the two big spheres that men's rights, and obviously there are anomalies to that, things like, you know, the circumcision debate and education of boys and things like that, but the military conscription. But there seems to be a lot of stuff regarding, for instance, single men adopting children, child custody, divorce laws, and alimony. And one of my big struggles to understand what's going on here is that, unfortunately, men's rights activists speak as if things like adoption and divorce laws are some sort of homogenous, across the board, constant, you know, variable, when in fact they're very different. Like, they're different up here in Canada than they are in the US. They're different between various U.S. states, between various Canadian provinces. They're different country to country. And so it's like, what state, what province, what area of the state are you dealing with? It's very different factors regarding this. And I think that if the rational mind kicked in, they'd be able to recognize this and rationalize it. Unfortunately,
I have a thought on that, but I'll remember that.
You're dealing with guys who, let's face it, they get interested in these issues because they have either been separated from their children or feel like they have been denied any relationship, or they're terribly hurt by a marriage that went bad. And they're not in a position to be rational and critical thinkers about it, and yet they have no pathway to get there. And that's where I think the real issue and all of this adoption and child custody and divorce and all that stuff, because at least I know in province of Ontario where I live, there's no gendered, it's not a gender bias. It's simply who spends more time with the child before the marriage separates. It has nothing to do with women making better mothers. It's who is the primary caregiver. Will they get physical custody? Our family courts actually prefer joint custody in terms of major decision making. And so a lot of these things, it's like, I know that in states like California, divorce is still very adversarial.
Yes.
And see, and again, you deal with completely different issues in the state of California than you do in, you know, province of Ontario, where we have very strict mandates regarding awarding of custody and child support payments. Mm-hmm. It's the non-custodial parent based on percentage of income, up to 61% of total income. So it's the equivalent of almost three kids.
Wow.
And there are elements, there are people who argue they're trying to prevent divorce. They're trying to see, are you really willing to live on 40% of your income.
Income.
But they're also based on studies that have said, well, this is the amount of income that parents would on average be spending on their children anyway.
On their kids children are expensive. Anyways.
It's about 21-22% per kid, right? Mm-hmm. At no point did I mention gender. This is all a formula based on earning and, you know, who sacrificed
custody.
Who sacrificed their career to raise the kids, right? Now, the reality is that men are still tend to be higher income earners than women, especially men tend to make more money than their wives.
Yeah.
This is just so. There's no morality judgment on it. Men tend to spend more time at work. Women are more likely to be the primary caregivers. Women are the ones that put their careers on the back burner to raise their kids. And this is because, you know, paternity leave is we're getting there, but it's not there yet.
It's not there yet, yeah.
There's no conspiracy here. But trying to tell an aggrieved guy in a state of crisis this is a non-starter. Because they're feeling so acutely.
Right. When you feel like the ground has been taken out from under your feet, you're not going to be the most centered person. Unless you're one of those people who have extraordinary force of character and will to be able to center yourself in the middle of that crisis.
And I would say both parts of the couple that's dissolving have to be that way. Now, the truth is, the cold hard truth is, and it was actually divorce lawyers who told me this, in province of Ontario where I live, the system is absolutely not interested in either of the parents because they are considered grown-ass adults. Yeah. My turn, not theirs. The only rights that the family court system in Ontario is interested in is not the rights of either parent. It's the rights of the child.
The child.
Because the child is considered not age of majority, therefore not old enough to speak for themselves. And courts are smart enough to know that two parents in the midst of a divorce, they're not thinking clearly enough to advocate for their own kids' rights.
Right.
And so the courts decide, well, we are the advocates for any children. If there's no children in a marriage, then a divorce becomes straight up contract law.
Right.
And there's no rights involved, which people don't want to hear. I know when I took my first law course, the idea that marriage was contract law deeply offended me. It offended all my concepts of romance. I had not yet read Tristan and Isolde encountered the idea of domestic love versus romantic love. So I was horribly offended that the idea that marriage was a contract. Oh, as you get older, you realize how much that's true. That doesn't mean you don't love your spouse.
Right.
It's just that the institution of marriage is a binding contract, and that is why it matters. That is what's good about it. That is the commitment part of commitment. Right. Right. So, you know,
I mean, if you would not sign a contract with the person you're in love with and you want to marry, maybe you should evaluate the state of your relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of state of relationships, a very fraught thing. And I've talked a lot about this on the YouTube channel is this whole Johnny Depp Amber Heard thing, which has made everybody go absolutely crazy because I think anybody who's listened to those tapes that were released, it's impossible to not feel for the guy when, you know, his wife is sitting there saying, I didn't punch you. I slapped. It wasn't even a proper slap. I don't know what my hand was doing.
Yeah.
It's impossible to not feel for the guy. And people are trying to make this into anything more than a particularly bad scene and try to apply it to a greater context, and you can't do that. I mean, that's one of the first mistakes of critical thinking is take an anecdote and try to apply it to the larger whole.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how many people do this thoughtlessly when emotions are on the line because their subjective perspective suddenly becomes reality in that moment. There is no objective truth more outside their subjective perspective.
Their subjective experience. And, you know, when it is a content that is so shocking, it does kind of act like a gyroscope, that if you start off balance, it'll ensure you remain off balance throughout the experience.
Well, it's also just the way the human brains work. I learned this when I was doing charitable nonprofit work, that when you give people statistics, they tune out.
Yes.
So, you know, the idea that only 8% of people who go to the police with a sexual assault allegation, 8% of women turn out to be provably lying. Mm-hmm. We hear that statistic, but it doesn't hit the parts of our brains that a first-person narrative does.
Right, because of the mentality.
But also because our brains have a negative bias, right? Like, I'm not a big fan of evolutionary psychology, but the argument is that we're prone to focus on negatives because, you know, if a bush rushes and you ran away, well, you're alive. But if a bush rustles and you ignore it, you might get eaten by a tiger. And there are things in present day, people, you know, our brains are, well, you did that and hurt. Don't do that. That's the purpose of pain, right? Telling us what not to do. And so the anecdotal stories that we are confronted with real people and real details, hit us on a totally different level than statistics do.
And part of it is because, as Terry Pratchett, should we also do a drinking game with Terry Pratchett? Because I figure he might come up quite a bit too.
Yeah, but that's got to be a sweet drink. Like Ayn Rand is like a really peaty scotch.
Yes.
Like Terry Pratchett's like a daiquiri.
A daiquiri or yeah. Irish cream.
Yeah, or like, I don't know, what's that nasty, the blue curacao or something like that? Like Terry Pratchett's alcohol with an umbrella in it. That doesn't mean it won't get you drunk. It just means it doesn't burn on the way down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Terry Pratchett used to say that he disagreed with us being labeled Homo sapiens, that we should be considered pans narrans, the storytelling ape, because the way that we understand the world is through stories. And so the reason why a statistic does not hit us with the same level as, say, a personal anecdote is because the personal anecdote has a story behind it.
Right.
And, you know, we can create a certain level of empathy or identification with something that we consider closer to our own experience, a story that, you know, the narrative, as you said earlier, the narrative has more of an allure for us because, well, if you think about it, if you really, really think about it, the notion, for example, of an orderly universe, is in and of itself, the way that most people phrase it, is a
story. The just world fallacy you're talking about? Yeah.
Well, no, it's a story that we tell ourselves about the world. Math, in many ways, is a story that we tell ourselves about how we believe, you know, objective reality works, because it's the way that we understand it.
But that was also what Kant used to claim a priori knowledge made sense.
Right.
Mathematics has been used to argue both sides.
Right. The many things that Kant did not get right.
That dirty, dirty Kant.
That dirty. I like that one. That should be a t-shirt too.
We can't even write now. There's a reason we keep saying that. But it's because philosophers like Kant are lionized. Mm-hmm. Because they kind of came out with a big, thick book before anybody else did.
Well, here's the thing. Kant was sort of he didn't really like reason that much. Kant was a man of extreme faith, and he believed that faith and reason were incompatible. And his whole critique of pure reason was sort of him creating a straw man argument of what reason was.
Oh, it was absolutely a straw man argument.
And yeah.
Because he was arguing that reason, true reason, pure reason, could only come from thought processes, not through observation.
Mm-hmm.
Which anyone of a scientific bent is like, what? No.
Exactly. Because you can't really say, well, you can make all sorts of so-called deductions starting from a premise. But the problem is if your premise is invalid, that is why you always test the hypothesis with evidence.
Precisely. Precisely. Now, the problem is when the evidence is so emotionally shocking that you're like, well, there it is. And I mean, the big statistic that is used as a cudgel by the men's rights movement to pivot to criminal justice is the, now this is only one study, but it hasn't been refuted yet. And it's from 2015, is that sentences for men are on average 63% longer than sentences for women, prison sentences for the same, on paper, the same crime. Now, this seems extremely cut and dried and offends, you know, the our entire concepts of fairness. The problem is it's about as bullshit a concept as a single gender pay gap.
Yeah.
The fallacy, the problem with these statistics are they're dealing with groups of people that are too big, right?
Yes.
Like, you're not factoring for race. You're not factoring for socioeconomic bracket. Absolutely nothing. You're simply factoring for gender. And if you look down, even just on the female side, it's a reporting period from 1999 to 2017. It couldn't be 2017. It came out in 2015, so probably 2014. 2015. The chart I'm looking at goes to 2016, so somebody made a mistake here. But if you look at the trends, you see the disparity in sentencing for white women, black women, and women of other races and ethnicities increase. But the sentencing disparity for Hispanic women is notably and steadily decreasing, meaning Hispanic women are the only group of women that are achieving sentencing parity with men.
Interesting.
And it took me a lot of research to figure out why this is so. And keep in mind, most of the laws of our land, because our governments are predominantly male.
Yes.
In some committees, exclusively male.
Yes.
These laws are written by men, right? So there is no way that criminal law is an area where women are oppressing men. Women had nothing to do with the writing of these laws. What has happened is it started with the war on drugs.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the way sentencing works. And mandatory minimum sentencing, and the very specific, what are called downward departures, exceptions to mandatory minimum sentencing. And there are so few, as written, downward departures, meaning a judge can give a lesser sentence. There are a ton of upward departures, meaning they can sentence more than the maximum. Sorry, more than the minimum. More than the minimum. But the downward departures are very, very limited. One is if the federal prosecutor files a motion with the court. You've been seeing this a lot with Trump associates, that they were, you know, they gave substantial help, so they should get a lenient sentence. That's one of only two established federal downward departures from a mandatory minimum. The other is something called a safety valve provision. And what the safety valve provision is I'm going to read it straight out, affords relief from any otherwise applicable mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenders who have minimal criminal history, that is no more than one criminal history point, were not violent, armed, or high level participants, and provided the government with truthful information regarding the offense. And the reason this affects gendered sentencing, the reason there's such a gender disparity, is that two people can be charged with the same crime, but the details of that offense, especially regarding drugs, are qualitatively different. So for instance, two people are basically charged with drug trafficking. They were drug mules.
Right.
But the woman in this particular instance was very low level, wasn't involved in any organizing, may have been coerced, but also was fairly low level and gave information on someone higher up. The number of women in jail, the percentage of women in jail for drug-related offenses is statistically significantly higher than men. There's and women are much less likely to reoffend, so the recidivism rate is lower. So we're dealing with that safety valve provision, meaning no more than one prior brush with the law, mm-hmm. right? This is exactly what we're dealing with. And it has nothing to do with gender. It is not, there might be some stuff where it's the bias of the judge, but then you get into the fact that, you know, black men, as a rule, get 19% longer sentences than white men. So obviously yes. there's more than just gender. But
yeah, there's more at play.
Yeah, but that big a disparity, that isn't the personal bias of the judge, because that can be overruled on appeal and judges don't like being appealed. So eventually they'd stop doing that. Mm-hmm. It's these safety valve provisions that actually create the disparity. So again, on the surface, the correlation between gender and sentencing seems very damning. But when you actually dig down, when you actually observe, when you actually break the data into more manageable chunks, you get a very different picture. And it was interesting because my dig, I twigged to the anomaly that is Latina mm-hmm. women.
Yes.
And the reason, a big reason that that's the case is the particular nature of Latina women and gangs. Latina women and gangs are fierce. And obviously this is a generalization, but it's that sort of thing that if it was just based on gender, you would see across the board similar trend lines. The fact right. that there's this anomaly indicates there's more going on. And sorry, go ahead.
And that's really the core of it. One thing that I have noticed for many, many years is that the presentation of statistics to bolster an argument or an agenda has become something that, in a way, it becomes unquestioned. You have, he has presented these statistics there. This is a factual thing. But they don't realize. Most people don't. I don't know if it's because of how statistics are presented in schools or even if that is studied in depth at all.
Statistics are used in academia by people who don't understand statistics.
Yeah. And here's the thing. When you do research and you want to find out, when you have figures as your end result of an inquiry, and people see these figures, many, many people look at the figure and go, well, that's the way it must be. They don't consider, well, what is the question that was asked
right.
to get this result? What was the sample pool like? What was discarded? What was included and why?
Yeah. Well, the number one rule for me of critical thinking is don't rush to judgment and don't jump to conclusions, which I know mm-hmm. is a tautology. It's saying the same thing in two different ways, but I'm trying to make sure the maximum number of people understand it. Very smart people come to very dumb conclusions by not stopping, backtracking, and checking their work.
All the time.
And it's frustrating because it's so human.
Yes, and unfortunately, reason is not automatic. It would be so much, everything would be so much easier if it were.
Well, reason is learned, and that's what makes it so hard. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is why I'm trying to be, I think in this case, being kind and being rational to proponents of the men's rights movement are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
because I am not going to get wrapped up in the same excessive emotionality that they're displaying. That would make me, you know better, no worse, right? And it at some point, somebody has to step back and go, okay, I'm not going to just respond in kind. I'm not going to counterpunch. Counterpunching is an irrational response. It's a fight or flight response, right?
Yes.
And one of the big issues with men's rights and feminism and all that stuff is a lack of emotionality is seen as deviant in women. Mm-hmm. And so no matter how you react to some of these, you know, blinded by emotion claims, you're seen as, and I get this all the time, I'm considered dishonest because I don't get overcome by emotionality. It's an issue because there's this wonderful article. It's on a site I'd never heard before called narratively.com. Mm-hmm. And it's called, I was an angry men's rights activist. Now I'm a fierce feminist. Clickbait headline, right?
Right.
And the first, I don't know, 20 paragraphs or so, it was all exactly what you expect. Personal narrative, a lot of emotion. And then it takes an interesting turn. He starts talking about signing up for sociology courses because he decides he's going to beard the lion in his own den, which is a bit of a mixed metaphor because female lions don't have beards.
Right.
But he took courses and was actually challenged by his professors and fellow students from a rational perspective and didn't just get shut down. That chill didn't come over the conversation the way he had every other time in his life, right? He went in looking to gird his loins with academic qualifications to prop up his men's rights ideas. And he took a intro to gender theory. And if your toes are curling, that's fine. Often intro to gender theory courses are awful. But the teacher asked, what does gender mean to you? And he answered, you know, everyone else talked about their lived experiences, he says, as women or gay men. And he said, when it was my turn, I said, I'm here to offer a man's point of view on gender. The article says, my instructor smiled and said, well, you must love our textbooks then. And there were masculinities and the men and boys. And, you know, these books are about gender from the perspective of men's lived experiences. Mm-hmm. And at that point, he realized, he said, men are socialized to be stoic, rational beings. The only emotions we're allowed are anger and joy. And in a precious few instances, we're allowed to cry, like if our sports team loses. As an MRA, I always believed it was women and feminism putting men into this box. But these feminist texts not only validated the crisis of masculinity, they pointed out men are the biggest policers of masculinity. Men beat each other down for being girly, for liking sewing or baking, for crying, for being, this is a quote, faggots, you got to man up, you can't be a pussy, right? MRAs and feminists were acknowledging the same problems, but the MRAs weren't locating the right cause. And he said that this began his movement away from men's rights activism. He said, though, my transformation didn't happen overnight. There wasn't really an aha moment, but more of a progression. I had to deconstruct all the MRA beliefs I had internalized. My classmates shuddered every time I opened my mouth. I would write these pro men's rights amendments that I thought made sense, but my instructors would say, this is a tautology. And what I read, not between the lines, what he's actually saying is that classmates shuddering didn't persuade him. The rational pushback was what actually made him start thinking.
Right.
That he was prepared, because one of the things that these movements do is they prepare people for the angry backlash, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, they're going to get mad at you and this proves you're right.
Right. And they thrive in that because it creates a sense of unity that, hey, we are under attack, but that's we're right. under attack together.
But when somebody doesn't attack and they just blandly say, this is a tautology, you're basically saying the same thing, over and over and over again. You are using your opinion as proof of your opinion, which tends to be what's happening when people commit tautologies. That all of a sudden, it's not emotional anymore. It's not subjective. It's objectively, yeah, and a lot from, and I hate to say this, from Gloria Steinem to Andrea Dworkin, everything post, well, I won't say everything, but a lot of the stuff that was published in magazines and things like, you know, what is it? Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema, the Laura Mulvey essay that defined the male gaze. You know, none of this had intellectual rigor. Simone de Beauvoir had intellectual rigor, even though she made some errors, because she wasn't writing a feminist text. She was writing an existentialist text. She considered herself Sartre, right? Betty Friedan was doing a journalistic deep dive in the feminine mystique. But these books, much like Warren Farrell's 1993 book, were intended to be works of intellectualism, but they struck an emotional chord.
Yes, and that is always, always the greatest danger you can have.
And I think that's a lot of the problem with how people respond to philosophy. Would you agree that they think they're thinking, but they're actually responding to the beauty of the words?
Yes, and also, well, take a shot, Ayn Rand.
See, her prose is quite harsh. Her fiction is quite flowery. And yes. I think that's why people glommed on to things like Atlas Shrugged and not her philosophical essays, where she actually said what she thought, not what her individual characters thought, but what she thought. And I actually think that to truly understand where she was coming from, you can't read a work of fiction that's about, you know, people falling in love and having sex and blowing up a train tunnel.
The train trail collapses. Nobody blows it up, but it's...
Right. But they plot it. You're right. They plotted too. That's a work of fiction. It has to tell a story. It has to be exciting. And the different characters have different points of view. Now, yes, it's soapboxy, but it's a narrative. When you actually read a lot of her essays from the Objectivist newsletter.
Or like her essay against racism in the 60s.
Yeah, or predicting the current Trumpian politics by way of Nixon.
And not liking it one bit.
They're shotguns. They are cannons. There is no flowery language there. It's very masculinized. The speech. And
I have a theory that a good amount of the backlash against Rand is because she communicated in this way, and she suffered from, she was of course abrasive in her own right, but she also, I believe, suffered backlash because she was a woman in many ways a predominantly male field, academia at the time, but she was not, she was arguing like a man. She was putting her point across and communicating in a very masculine way. She was not smiling. Yeah. She was not trying to be, in many ways, actually, a lot of her, I call it on stage, there's a performer in me, a lot of her lecturing and dialogue presence seemed very similar to that of Gloria Steinem when you see her on when you see her debating, etc.
The robotic quality?
Yeah.
That's not interesting, because Rand strikes me as her it's a shield, whereas Steinem always struck me as a mask.
As the mask. But it's the effect.
I see your similarities, though. I absolutely see it. A lot of Gloria Steinem's persona, public persona, was performative.
Right. And Rand was not comfortable. That's right. She's still alive. Rand was not comfortable speaking in public, not because she had issues with the language, because she mastered English, but it was because she could never get rid of her accent. And she was painfully aware that her accent occasionally made her very hard to understand.
That's very interesting. But also the constructs of speech when English is your second language, the constructs of your native tongue never quite leave you.
Mm-hmm.
And
they occasionally come in, yeah.
Yeah, especially when you were on painkillers, you got very Spanish
in, oh, yeah.
in your structures. I'm like, oh, that's cool. But she is very Russian in the way she puts things together. And that's not an insult. It's refreshing.
And if you if you read a lot of Russian literature, that can get also very soapboxy. You know, she was emulating in many ways like the styles of Victor Hugo. And if you've ever read The Count of Monte Cristo, you got Dumas as well.
In her fiction, there was definitely a lot of that.
Yeah, you have the Victor Hugo. Like if you've read The Hunchback of Notre Dame, you have those long speeches there. And if you read like Alexandre Dumas, and you've read The Count of Monte Cristo, you have that as well. It was part of the literary style of the 18th century.
Yeah, it's Romanticism.
Romanticism.
Yeah.
But here's the thing: the point that I was thinking about when you were mentioning the fiction versus mm-hmm. Versus the philosophical essays is oftentimes, how people react to philosophy and many people react to the words of philosophy, which is why they feel so so bewitched by Immanuel Kant, who did a lot of linguistic obfuscation to the point that even expert translators tear their hair out, or Jacques Derrida. In
the way only the German language could.
Yes, it's a thing of beauty. If you step back and go, wow, what did you do with that sentence?
Very, very harsh, lengthy, run-on beauty. Yeah.
Yes. Jacques Derrida, who is the master of saying nothing a lot and for a long time.
because he is the father of all hot takes.
Of all hot takes. But, if you look at, Rand's flowery, fiction. Yeah. You compare it with the philosophy, the philosophical writings, as you pointed out. A lot more people believe that they know Rand's philosophy solely from the fiction and do not read, in many cases, any of her essays.
Yeah, they assume she's Dagny Taggart.
Right. And they something that, for example, people don't seem to realize is that for example, Dagny Taggart makes errors in the novel.
Yep.
Almost every single character except John Galt. John Galt, for example, at the start, has already made the errors. He's now in the point where he's no longer making the mistake, but everybody else, is. He's not the protagonist. The protagonist is Dagny Taggart.
Yeah, and her journey. We can't be sure whether Galt makes no mistakes or Taggart just does not observe any of his mistakes. There's a bit of an unreliable narrator thing going on.
Right. And she doesn't spend that much time with him. But one thing that I've noticed is, for example, that I get a lot of people who have the emotional reaction about Ayn Rand. And they say, well, this was not something that happened to me, but I was watching a show. John Stossel was asking questions about what people thought Ayn Rand stood for. Mm-hmm. And someone said, well, her selfishness means that if you're walking along a boardwalk mm-hmm. and you see someone who is
the Mr. A scenario that Steve Ditko put in his comic books. Yeah.
Yes. And I have a whole thing to say about Steve Ditko. I mean, I admire his art, but he kind of went a little cray cray, but
I think you've just said it very succinct. Okay.
Stevie did go a little bit cray cray. I was so sorry to see all of that, but, so this audience member said that if you see Ayn Rand's objectivism means that if you see a man drowning and you're walking mm-hmm. across the boardwalk and you have the opportunity to throw him a lifesaver or to save them, you shouldn't because you're selfish. And I stood back and I watched and I thought, well, where, even if you just read the novel, where in the novel does anything like that even remotely come up?
If you read her essays, she actually refutes that outright. Like, no, it's not about that. Her own personal behavior did not reflect that. She was very charitable.
She said, she would say, if you are if in the attempt to save someone, that, for example, that you don't know, you know, if you find yourself in absolute immediate mortal danger, you shouldn't.
And that's just rational, because right. you can make it worse.
Right. But she says, you know, if this is a person or that means the world to you, that changes.
Right.
And she's, you know, she's acting on, in the moment of an emergency, you're going to have snap reactions, and you will, her argument is that you will act in an emergency, you will act in accordance to the values that you have upheld up to that point, things that right. have become by habit. So, you know, if your first habit then is to try and save a complete stranger, even though it puts yourself in at risk of your own life, you ask yourself later on, after you've done it, so why did I do this? Do I consider this valuable? You have to introspect and come up with your own reasons and be satisfied that the reason that you chose is a rational one. And, you know, and she says, you know, I would risk my life to save my husband, because my husband, Frank O'Connor, is the value. He's my top value. Without the notion of a life without him is so horrifying, so striking to me, that I would risk my life to preserve that value.
And that, I think, that sense of, some would call it altruism, some would call it
benevolence. You know,
well, benevolence, or just sort of, she'd call it rational selfishness. I think that's what gets hijacked in these guys that end up in the men's rights movement. Because mm-hmm. what happens when you do have to live without this person you don't want to live without?
Exactly.
There's no framework for what happens next. For, you know, we're starting to develop it. We're starting to see, that's what I find so interesting about the show Blue Bloods, the Tom Selleck character. He's a widower. With three kids. And so it's one of the few examples I've seen where they actually deal with the lingering grief from the loss, not only of his wife, but one of his kids who died in the line of duty.
And there's no, at this point, men have not been given not just the language to express this grief, but also men themselves, because of this culture that has been created around this type of masculinity, there are very, very few safe spaces in which this can be expressed without, you know, other men policing that masculinity and going, you're being weak, you're being a pussy,
yep.
all of those things. You know, yep. eventually they might even consider that the only place that they can express their sorrow, their grief, their anguish, or their anger, anger is okay, considered okay to express, is their psychiatrist or psychologist's office. And in many cases, they might even consider going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist as a sign of weakness.
Yeah, and so they don't tell their psychiatrist the truth.
Yeah, and they don't tell their psychiatrist the truth, which, you know, it is not healthy. It eventually only worsens the problem, because you're living kind of a double emotional life where you're keeping up this front, but you're collapsing inside.
And these guys blame women for this state of affairs, when mm-hmm. in fact, it's the masculinity born of martial cultures that yes. was constructed by men to create, it basically turned men into different classes of men. There were the politicians and the generals who had to stay alive, and then everyone else was disposable. The thing of disposable male syndrome that men's rights activists talk about all the time. Mm-hmm. That concept did not come from women. That concept came from military structures where yeah. they were basically training. When countries mobilize rapidly for war, they're not training elite soldiers a lot of the times. They are training cannon fodder. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so these disposable male structures came from the minds of other men. And I think that that idea is so horrifying to some people that it's easier to blame women because it's less of an Ouroboros, it's less of a serpent eating its own tail.
It's also more concrete.
Because the woman's right in front of you, the generals from the 1930s are dead or old.
Right, and the relationship that has just ended or that is in trouble or the relationship you can't get, that you feel you cannot get, is a lot more tangible and more immediately relatable to you emotionally.
It's basically Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler, the idea that she mm-hmm. wasn't a woman, she was all women to him.
Yes, she was the woman.
The woman, yeah. And that's something that I think gets missed a lot in modern portrayals. I mean, good Lord, don't get me started on the BBC Sherlock, where they reimagine him as a high-functioning sociopath. A high-functioning sociopath would never think that.
Yeah,
the overwhelming, overcome by emotions, that would not happen.
No.
It's almost like... There's a legitimate need, there's a legitimate urge in the men's rights movement. But it's being hijacked by the wrong paradigms and the wrong language, because that's what they're allowed to talk about as opposed to what they really want to talk about.
Yes.
And often, I mean, the whole concept of talk therapy is using rational analysis to isolate, identify, and process emotions. Mm-hmm. And this is the process. I think the feminist movement, that the men's rights activism movement is a big, large part, a response to, a backlash against. Both of these movements need this, is that they need a heavy dose of rationality. They need a heavy dose of critical thinking. They need to both take good hard look in the mirrors and start actually becoming accountable and actually looking at the morality of the choices they are making in how they choose to fight these fights.
Maybe move away from the dark side.
Yes. For people who don't know, I refer to the essentialist perpetual victimhood of Andrea Dworkin as the dark side. Do not fall to the dark side.
Move
towards the light.
And, search your feelings.
People then ask me, well, what can I read? What feminist literature can I read? And that's a tough question. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the stuff that I would recommend is modern stuff like Reviving Ophelia by Mary Pfeiffer, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls, Odd Girl Out by Rachel Simmons, but they're all about teenagers, right? There's very few dispassionate critiques of adulthood of either gender, because then it devolves into the minute people are assumed to be fully formed people and they're not, it devolves into first person overly emotionalized narrative, and we've got a real problem that way.
Yeah, we have a lot of people who in one way or another, due to different circumstances, have sort of ended up with a stunted emotional development.
Oh, I wouldn't say stunted. I'd say that's exactly what's going on, men and women alike.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because we have been so forced into this artificial binary where things like gender and race and, you know, sexual orientation, gender identity, all that stuff, are believed to supersede the individual, which study after study,
collectivism.
Yeah, they've shown it hasn't. The differences between individuals far outweigh any gender differences, any race differences, anything like that. Individualism is real.
Right. The individual is the smallest minority.
But the funny thing is, so many people, and you know, I talked with people, you know, they're Redditors or they frequent 4chan or things like that. They actually believe they need anonymity. And so they need, you know, 4chan, the joke, the hacker known as 4chan, because 4chan mm-hmm. is the collective that people identify because everyone's anonymous. They feel like they need to be an anonymous cog in that collective to be safe.
Well, because being an individual requires living by your, in many ways, by yourself in accordance to what is what you consider to be the best choices for you. And those choices can be scary, especially when you feel that the whole world might be against you or that the cards are stacked against you. Being an individual, acting like an individual requires a level of responsibility. And for a lot of people, responsibility comes with choices that can change your life, can shake you to the core. And that is terrifying for a lot of people. Whereas the illusion, because it is really an illusion, mm-hmm. that you just melt into this collective and the collective will take care of you. So you are no longer responsible for the decision, but we all are responsible for the decision, and therefore not one sole person can have their finger pointed at them and be blamed and be made to, you know, own up for their choices. Can be a very seductive notion. It's the impulse to have a tribe. Mm-hmm. And ultimately it is psychologically nothing more than the wish to distribute the responsibility that really should be yours for your own life onto other people.
All right, I think that's a good place to stop, Mouse. In honor of the topic, I'm going to give you the first and the last word. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast. I said it right twice.
Yay!
Like what you've heard, we went all over the place, but there was a through line there. Wow, we went through like what, about 6,000 years of philosophical thought in an hour and a half ish. So if you like this sort of podcast, if you've been enjoying us on your workout or your commute or while you're cleaning or doing dishes or something like that or anything else, we don't judge. Go to funetwork.tv, buy a shirt, do a PayPal donation, become a monthly patron. Patronage really, really helps. The patron, building that patron is really, really important. funetwork.tv. And until next time, remember, thinking is good for you even when it hurts.
And critical thinking comes from a place of stillness.
Hey, you hear that? No, listen. You hear that? That's right, there's nothing. And that's all there'll be when you go looking for intelligent, sensible, rational dialogue on political issues that also have a sense of humor. That's if you don't support FU politics. That's right, you can support this podcast. Go to patreon.com/FUNetworkTV. patreon.com/FUNetworkTV. Subscriptions start at $1 a month, or give us a one-time boost at PayPal. Our address is funetworktv@gmail.com. Otherwise, when you want to hear intelligent discourse about Canadian and international politics, all you're going to hear is this. Yep, dead silence, or a bunch of bozos and pundits yelling at each other. Make the right choice. Subscribe today. I'm Ed the Sock, and I approve this message. If you don't like it, to hell with you.